Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we're going to talk Bed Bath & Beyond. Actually, they lead the show, the Lone Retail Earnings Call this week. We're also going to talk 7-Eleven. You know, we just talked about convenience stores a couple of weeks ago. What we have to talk about regarding 7-Eleven dovetails pretty nicely with that study we discussed a couple of weeks ago. We'll also wrap up the news portion of our show by talking about back-to-school season projections. And of course, we'll be looking ahead to a few stories at the tail end of the show. A reminder, you can like us, rate us, however you find us, on Instagram or Twitter as well, at Retail Podcast. Every rating that you give us, good or bad, helps us out, because if it's a bad rating, it helps us improve. If it's a good rating, it helps others find us, so to speak. So again, we start today's show with Bed Bath & Beyond. And despite a beat on earnings on an adjusted basis, and that's the key term, adjusted basis, the stock fell by over 8% in early trading on Thursday, following their call on Wednesday, July 10th. And I was actually talking with a coworker of mine, Leighton, about some of the stock prices metrics. Now, we don't get deep into stock prices, whether we think they're going to go up or down. That's not really our say. We're more focused on the retail initiatives. But he asked me why exactly Bed Bath & Beyond was trading so low given their earnings multiple. And I told him basically it's a number of things. And those are the type of things that we're going to talk about, because they've now posted earnings beats in three consecutive quarters, but after each quarter, the stock price has gone down.
Yeah, that's right. It's not been that great of a stock, and this is a company that we haven't been too bullish on in previous podcasts, even though, Trent, you make the very valid point that we don't make predictions about stock prices. We typically just talk about the performance of the companies in the short to mid-term, but you look at Bed Bath & Beyond, it is certainly a very, very bad setup for an investor right now. If you look at Bed Bath & Beyond, they've been having multiple troubles over the past few years, not only due to their financial performance, but obviously that's as a result of their merchandising and what they do operationally. And if you look into those numbers, Trent, while they beat on adjusted earnings, as you had said, this beat was due to the adjustment to remove an over $400 million impairment charge, as well as costs of severance, by the way. And analysts expected an adjusted figure of 8 cents per share, but Bed Bath & Beyond came in at around 12 cents per share. So you might ask, what is up with that massive impairment charge? It was actually referenced in the call as a goodwill and trade name impairments related to the North American Retail Reporting Unit. This allows an impairment charge of over $500 million in the fiscal fourth quarter of 2018. Same-store sales were awful. This is obviously the metric that we often use when talking about publicly traded retail companies. But to put it bluntly, Trent, this was just not the greatest quarter in terms of same-store sales. Analysts expected a drop of 5.6%, which was bad enough. You think about a negative figure such as 5.6%, not good at all. But Bed Bath & Beyond actually beat that, if you will, at a negative 6.6% margin. And if you look, what was odd about this, at least to us, was the fact that there was higher average ticket size over the last year. You hardly ever see that in this case, such a large comp decline. Usually you would see that both traffic and ticket size were down. Of course, traffic was down significantly enough to overcome any gain in average ticket, which was interesting enough. And oddly enough, they mentioned Easter being later in the quarter than in 2018, as though that somehow affected the quarter-long comps. Specifically, they said it would reduce the tailwind effect from people looking to refresh their homes for spring, and if it had an impact at all, it would have been tiny compared to the 6.6% drop they experienced overall. Revenue came in short of expectations, around $10 million as well, at $2.57 billion in total. This is a 6.6% fall from last year's first quarter top-line figures, right in line with the comp declines. Maybe the only positive that came out of the numbers was the company's cash position at $923 million in cash and cash equivalents, up 9% over the same time last year. And Trent, throughout the call, a lot of good, a lot of bad. And we've said on the show in the past that Bed Bath & Beyond's initiatives either haven't taken off or haven't been implemented soon enough.
Yeah, I don't know that there was even a lot of good on the call. A lot of it was pretty lackluster, if you will. And what struck me on the call is this was the first call, of course, with Mary Winston as their interim CEO after the stepping down of their former CEO, Stephen Tamaris. And not much came from Winston in the canned press release. So as we often do, we went to that earnings call to follow up on some of their larger initiatives put into place after Tamaris left. Now, something that caught us off guard was Winston's scathing evaluation of the current state of the business. It's not very often that you hear an interim CEO, even one that's coming over from a board position, say some of the things that she did. Now, in the press release, she said all the right things about wanting to improve shareholder value, but one of the first things she said on the call, and as I was listening to this, I nearly fell out of my seat. She said, "It is clear that the company has not kept pace with how the customer has evolved and how customers shop today." And that's a quote from that earnings call. Now, she did kind of turn it around and say, "Hey, we feel as though the company can be turned around. There's a great brand here." And then started saying a lot of the right things after that. But it's rare to hear a CEO, even a new CEO or an interim CEO of a company, say, "To be honest, we haven't kept pace at all, and we got a lot of room to make up." Now, one of their largest initiatives heading into this fiscal year was their SKU optimization program. They're attempting to weed out SKUs that were essentially either collecting dust on store shelves or weren't bringing much profitability for Bed Bath & Beyond. But this wasn't actually explicitly mentioned in the opening comments as a facet of one of their four key near-term priorities. In fact, it wasn't until they started going over the financials when that SKU optimization plan came up, and it was mentioned during discussion specifically of falling same-store sales. They mentioned that the top line for each store, those same-store sales for each store, was bound to take a hit because the company was focusing on more profitable SKUs, meaning they took off the shelves some of the less profitable SKUs, meaning those stores weren't selling those products, causing the loss in same-store sales. But at the same time, you kind of wonder, how much is that alienating customers? Not everyone can get away with that type of a plan. You know, limiting SKUs might be a benefit to some of their banners, like Bed Bath & Beyond, for example, or Bye Bye Baby, but it might also be a hindrance to World Market, because World Market, as we know, is owned by Bed Bath & Beyond, or under that banner, and it thrives on a treasure hunt concept, similar to an off-price store, although without the off-price prices. And by focusing only on the products with the higher margins, this is a lot closer to the RH or Restoration Hardware model, less like the Walmart or Target model. And we have to wonder, for the long term, is that something that the customer base of their main flagship stores, is that something that the customer base is going to buy going forward? They've also worked to exclude more SKUs from promotional activity. Nothing makes customers happier than finding that 20% off coupon that they got in the mail doesn't work on the product that they're trying to buy. They're also placing minimum quantities on some other SKUs. So all of this basically leading to fewer sales in the short term. The company hopes it'll make them more profitable. By the way, those 20% off mailings, the company is kind of looking at maybe tailing some of those back. They were able to save on marketing costs this quarter because they're kind of looking at that, wondering exactly how effective it is. But again, we go back to talking about Victoria's Secret and what they did about 3 years ago with kind of curtailing their coupon program, curtailing their mail order program. Yeah, you're right. It's probably not going to be effective for all of your customer base. For example, I can't ever remember using one of those 20% off coupons, though I've gotten probably hundreds of them in my life. Most of them end up in the recycle bin. But your core customer is going to be looking for those things in the mail. So can they pick out their core customer versus their not core customer? And can they focus on them? Another question for the company going forward. And a lot of their priorities on the call, it sounded more like empty platitudes, but we set aside our own personal bearishness, which should be evident by this point, to kind of hear them out regarding these four priorities. So what are the four priorities that they talked about on the call, Leighton?
It's interesting that they even have priorities at this point, but first they want to stabilize sales and drive top-line growth. As we saw from the call, they've got a long way to go on that front. Specifically, they feel as though they can do this by better aligning their digital and in-store platforms, which Winston seems to feel that has not been done yet. She was implicitly critical of their e-commerce initiatives throughout the call. Second, they want to reset their cost structure. And this is interesting because this is something they've been talking about for some time in terms of cutting costs throughout parts of the company and streamlining certain areas. But by this, they mean they'd like to reduce both cost of goods sold and SG&A. This will be tough to do for cost of goods sold, especially with potentially looming tariff issues out there. But they've made some progress on the SG&A front so far. Specifically, Winston mentioned a staffing optimization program to better align staffing with store traffic spikes and a closer look at their advertising program, particularly with mail advertising. Third, they want to review the company's asset base. In other words, assessing whether the stores in their massive geographic base are even necessary. This means, of course, potential relocations, but also store closures. They want to evaluate store performance, not only based on profitability, which of course we feel fleet optimization programs look at, but also on viability of omnichannel initiatives. And this makes sense given the distribution network that they want to have going forward. This begins with evaluating demographics of each area and how likely they are to use buy online and pick up in store options. This way, even if a store is unprofitable, it may remain in the system if it can serve to add value to their e-commerce work. Fourth, they want to look at or overhaul their organizational structure. Basically, as we cut through all the buzzwords offered about this call, we look that it sounds more like strategic downsizing than anything. They mentioned that Beyond Plus membership program, and we've talked about this a little bit before, but we found it quite interesting that they maintain the program where it's actually hurting margins. The free shipping and around 20% off discount is realized by members at the time of the sale, but the company amortizes the membership fees across the entire year. Still, this feels like an odd margin-shaving initiative from a company that is actively attempting to build on margins. Regarding the program, they said, "We continue to evaluate the learning," whatever we think that means. But overall, hopefully they're using the data analytics to the benefit of the company. Customer insight, customer-specific offers, and content were all supposed to be positives regarding on the platform. Still, it seems there are easy ways to do this without murdering the margins they seem to care so deeply about with the SKU optimization program and their desire to decrease cost of goods sold as a percentage of sales.
Yeah, I don't know that I've heard a more odd quote on an earnings call than "we continue to evaluate the learning." They're not even learning at this point. They're just evaluating the learning. It's almost like meta-learning there. But in all, there wasn't too much different on this call versus a call under Stephen Tamaris. Most of their initiatives seem oddly hollow, which is a criticism of analysts in the past. And a lot of them, as Leighton mentioned, with those four key initiatives, they've been things that they've talked about for a while now, even if they haven't grouped them into the four main initiatives categories. And the next generation lab stores, which a lot of retail fans might recall, they were pushed so much on prior calls. They just renovated 40 stores in their pipeline into these next generation lab stores. Those stores were mentioned a whopping twice on this call. One in reference to CapEx, as far as where that CapEx is going, and another in the analyst Q&A as an initiative to build out omnichannel and changing the store experience, because analysts, of course, were wondering, you know, hey, if you guys haven't done the job when it comes to omnichannel yet, what are some platforms that you're going to use? And they said, well, we're going to, these next generation lab stores are designed to meet people where they're at, that type of thing, and we can't really get into other initiatives, which is actually how most of the questions on the call were answered. Either we can't get into that, it's too early to tell, so on and so forth. And I feel that lack of transparency also created some bearishness among the analysts that were on the call. But all of this, the entire call as a whole, just seemed like another example of what could be well termed as initiative ADD at the company. Or basically, it reminds me of throwing an entire pot of spaghetti at the wall instead of just one or two noodles to see what sticks. And at this point, it's nearly exhausting. Even if you're a fan of the company, you really just want to see them develop some initiatives and stick with it and see them through. And instead, they jump from one thing to another, in the meantime, seemingly alienating their core customer with some of these initiatives. And we've talked when we first started the show, we talked about the competitive moat that they had built regarding the registry business, that type of thing. The registry, again, was not mentioned on this particular call, either for Bye Bye Baby or Bed Bath & Beyond. And again, that's something they had a moat built 3 to 4 years ago, but they've let that moat kind of fill in with concrete. And now a lot of stores, including internet-based stores, are getting in on that. And they're beginning to lose kind of the wedding gift industry to gift cards and the like. So that's a dangerous thing for them. They could have really put some time and effort behind their registry program 3 or 4 years ago. They haven't done that in the interim, and so it's kind of withered away based on what it once was. Additionally, they continued to refuse to break down sales by segment. So we talked about all the different stores that are there. One Kings Lane, the online store that's ultimately what a lot of people are calling a failure. Bed Bath & Beyond, Bye Bye Baby, World Market. We don't have an idea of what's working at any of them or if one of them is perhaps outperforming the others. So we're kind of left to assume that all of it isn't going well. Not a lot of reasons for optimism here. And if we were retail landlords, knowing what they've said in the past about desiring short-term leases and reevaluating their portfolio, honestly, we'd be looking for other tenants as a backup plan, thinking that, hey, maybe these stores aren't going to be in our shopping center for too much longer at this rate. You know, Leighton, 88% of financially successful people read at least 30 minutes per day. I love reading personally. You know, the financially successful people, they're hungry for knowledge, continuously seek self-improvement and learning every chance they get, and our partner Blinkist gets you there faster than you can imagine.
If you're like me, Trent, the list of books you want to read is pretty much never ending, or those people that suggest you read something in particular is never ending and always expanding. You simply don't have time to read every single suggestion out there. Our sponsor Blinkist has solved your long list of must-reads once and for all. Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most impactful elements so you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes, all just from your phone. With Blinkist, you will expand your knowledge and learn more in just 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen pretty much anytime, anywhere.
And I like to listen to Blinkist while I'm driving to work because my commute is right around 15 to 20 minutes. It's perfect to fire up something on Blinkist and get the entire thing in during that drive. And the Blinkist library is massive. You've got timeless classics like Freakonomics to current Amazon bestsellers on their lists as well. My current recommendation is to check out Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion. That's a book that I took care of this last week. It's got 18 minutes on it, perfect for my drive. There's also The Power of Habit, and I also really enjoyed Thinking Fast and Slow. So all of those I would certainly recommend. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist is a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. You can cancel at any time. That's Blinkist.com/retail. Well, in a story that broke late last week, 7-Eleven wants to go back to the fresh food well more often with their convenience store offerings. And this news not only fits perfectly with our coverage of the recent third quarter convenience store retail poll that we discussed a few weeks ago, but we're actually recording the show on 7-Eleven, July 11th, so I felt like it was apropos to include it here. But speaking of that poll, the majority of convenience stores that were polled there reported that they were attempting to increase their fresh food offerings and saw fresh food as a new comp sales driver for their stores. And this article via, once again, the fantastic Maria Halkias of the Dallas Morning News, a great retail reporter, suggests that 7-Eleven is seeing the same thing and wants to jump even further on that bandwagon. Now, it was Maria that kind of brought this to our attention, but this stems from an earnings call that we'll get to here in just a little bit. And although 7-Eleven's behind the likes of Quick Trip, Casey's, and Come and Go in the regard of offering a robust selection of fresh food, 7-Eleven has been a decently early adopter of the practice when you compare them to some of the independently owned convenience stores that are out there.
those who listened to the old Food Focus podcast, the podcast which we dearly miss and probably no one else misses besides us because no one listened to it. But if you did listen to that podcast, you will perhaps recall that 7-Eleven is actually owned by Japan-based 7&I Holdings Company Limited. This announcement or revelation came as part of their earnings call last week. During that earnings call, they backed up many of the aspects of their larger survey that we covered, boasting a 3.4% comp sales increase in the most recent quarter and the highest operating income in the history of the United States 7-Eleven division. We should remember that this includes the newly acquired Sunoco chain as well. As part of their increased commitment towards ready-to-eat food, the company said they must first change the image of 7-Eleven in the United States. And this makes sense, as who wants to purchase food from the dingy corner store that's been there for over 15 years? This, again, is something that Quick Trip has never really had an issue with because their stores are always undergoing sort of a reinvention. Come and Go and Casey's also have recently undergone some store revitalization attempts, often expanding their stores and widening aisles in a similar attempt to clean up their image. And in order to clean up their image, Trent, you have to clean up the stores themselves. You have to sometimes bulldoze the entire store in order to reinvent yourself and then reinvent yourself in terms of how the customers feel about you on a day-to-day basis. It's massive, especially when you're trying to get into the fast or fresh food industry. Circle K has also dug to revitalize their look in many parts of the United States as well, by the way. It would be fair to say that 7-Eleven is behind all of these aforementioned options, a fact management seems to be well aware of, and we have to chalk it up to management for being self-aware in the first place. First on their list, as far as image revitalization is concerned, is strengthening store cleanliness. And I have that in quotation marks, strengthening store cleanliness. Of course, this will be helped by the renovations and expansions of the stores that are already pretty much undergoing a process to clean up. But it's a lot easier to keep the stores clean and easy to navigate if aisles are wider and so forth. So this sort of makes sense. Address the infrastructure parts first. Additionally, lighting will be crucial as some 7-Eleven locations have earned a reputation of being a little dark and sad, especially at night. Sometimes some of the corners are a little bit scary, but perhaps the most interesting thing to us about all of this are the parallels between their current initiatives and initiatives they originally launched way back around 2012. At that time, company representatives told produce industry magazine The Packer that they aim to have 20% of their overall sales come from fresh foods in the U.S. and Canadian stores. Notes in the article really are regarding the traction that fresh fruits and vegetables and healthy options overall were gaining at the retailer. So sales were going up, so they were going to address those by supplying more of those fresh fruits and vegetables. Part of the challenges at that time are basically the same challenges convenience stores face today with the expansion of fresh foods at their stores. Some lack daily delivery and non-bakery goods, product turnover, for instance. So you have a lot of stale goods. I see a lot of convenience stores with very, very old bananas, just as one example. Our point in mentioning the history of all of this is that change can be very glacial in retail in general, and especially in the convenience store industry.
Yeah, and Leighton, you make a good point bringing up those initiatives from 2012, 7 years ago. And although convenience stores were pretty quick to pick up sales of gasoline back in the 1970s, they sometimes advance at a crawl when it comes to other aspects of the business, and there are a lot of headwinds here, so it's not necessarily the fault of the convenience stores, but rather just the nature of this part of retail, and a lot of this is due to the massive number of independent operators. Now, while there is the bigger 7-Eleven banner, certainly in the United States, and they're said to have nearly 10,000 convenience stores in the U.S., the reality is some of 7-Eleven stores are licensed, and so they don't necessarily have the luxury of the direct corporate involvement that certain other locations do. Additionally, convenience stores, in terms of staffing, they see a lot of turnover in general, except, of course, Quick Trip, which is pretty much the exception for everything in this industry. That's why they are held on such a high pedestal, because a lot of employees will work there for years on end. There's a lot of benefits and bonus programs, but When you're 7-Eleven or a different convenience store retailer, it kind of makes it difficult to implement consistent changes on a store-by-store level because, you know, not only do you have that turnover there, but you've only got usually 1 to 2 staff members working at any given time. So it's difficult to work on revitalizations. It's difficult to work on things like making sure your stock is rotated properly because they can be spread a little bit thin. And that's, interestingly enough, something else that 7 and iCompany mentioned in this earnings call was actually the desire to cut down on staffing as a way to reduce costs. They're testing out some payment platforms that just require you to use your cell phone, very similar to Amazon Go, which everyone talks about, although this kind of slid underneath the radar, the whole pay by cell phone thing, have no cashier there in this circumstance for 7-Eleven. And you really have to wonder, if you're doing that and you're endeavoring to cut back on staff, how much can you really dip your toe into fresh foods? Now, a convenience store like Casey's, for example, and it was almost an antithesis to think of a convenience store selling pizza 20 years ago, much less fresh pizza, but you know, Casey's makes their pizza fresh in stores and they have a dedicated employee to do just that. So sometimes when it comes to fresh foods, it does mean building out your staffing. We see this in the grocery retail industry with grocerants. You have to have dedicated people there. Whole Foods, a great example of that. Also, Kroger, a great example of that, how they've been able to build out some of their fresh food and ready-to-eat food platforms. So again, interesting to see exactly how they go about implementing these things. But as Leighton said, at the very least, they have to avoid the brown bananas on the shelves in order to have success and in order to see the high margins that they're looking for from that particular product category.
Well, as I've talked about the last 2 or 3 weeks, I recently had a trip down to Medellin, Colombia for stem cells. Both my left knee and right ankle had been bothering me due to a couple different conditions, quadriceps tendonitis, and then a badly sprained right ankle. I came across a stem cell facility located in Medellin, Colombia called BioAccelerator via another podcast that I had listened to with Chael Sonnen, a former UFC fighter that swears by the treatment that he had received in Medellin, Colombia. And I was really put off at first because Medellin, Colombia, a lot of people think Colombia, they think third world country, not that at all. After my trip, I realized that a lot of their retail is actually similar to that in the US, and a lot of their infrastructure is also coming up. And over the last 10 to 20 years, they've had a resurgence in medical care. BioAccelerator is the global leader in stem cell therapy. They offer the state-of-the-art medical facility with the ability to treat patients with tens of millions of active adult stem cells to help them recover from injuries like the one I had, or other major medical complications that have happened over time. BioAccelerator currently offers treatments for a variety of conditions ranging from orthopedic injury, spine and disc injury, chronic pain, and even severe autoimmune disease, Trent. BioAccelerator has something for everybody out there looking to stay in the game and feeling youthful.
And Leighton will talk about his progression from injury and his process to overcome these injuries on next week's show. If you or someone you know suffers from a life of pain or complications due to a major medical condition, join the likes of UFC Hall of Famer Matt Hughes, the aforementioned Chael Sonnen, and Chuck Liddell, and join many others like Leighton and contact BioAccelerator. Start your path to wellness and become a BioX man or BioX woman today at www.bioaccelerator.com/theretailfocuspodcast and tell them Leighton sent you. That's BioAccelerator, BioAccelerator, BioAccelerator.com/TheRetailFocusPodcast, and tell them Leighton sent you. Close out the news portion of our show today with something we often talk about this time of year, as it's time to start forecasting back-to-school sales figures for retailers. Now, the National Retail Federation hasn't yet come out with their 2019 offerings. Unofficially, back-to-school initiatives kind of start after the July 4th seasonal merchandise moves out of retail stores, although they start in earnest at certain retailers, especially those that have the seasonal merchandise area. But It's only appropriate that we start to talk about it this week, and Deloitte published their yearly preview of back-to-school sales performance across the retail landscape in the U.S. this week. Now, last year, projections were generally positive, and results followed in that trend. And actually, the results beat the National Retail Federation's projected results last year. NRF projected actually a slight dip, but it went the other way. This year, though, may be a bit of a different story, according to Deloitte. Now, as far as the projections are concerned, Deloitte goes on the record as projecting positive back-to-school spending, although only slightly so. The projections include an overall increase of 1.8%, pushing back-to-school spending up to around $27.8 billion this year, based on their calculations. Now, one thing I need to mention is that if you pay any attention to some of these other numbers, back-to-school and college spending put together, the NRF, their numbers come in well higher than Deloitte's numbers do, even when you include college spending, which we'll get to in just a second. So that $27.8 billion, just remember, take it with a bit of salt there, because Deloitte is using basically a different practice to account for those sales than the NRF is and some of the other projection systems. So if you see anything about that in the news, just know they're kind of using different routes to get to that data. But either way, that comes out to around $519 per student. Leighton, I wish our parents had spent anything more than maybe $50 on us going back to school any given year. And although CNBC says this is relatively flat, and I quote that from their headline, it's not a bad increase at all, considering impacts from inflation have been muted somewhat with lower fuel prices. Now, as I mentioned, these numbers are just for K through 12. Deloitte projects spending of $25.1 billion by parents on students going back to college. So a difference there between K-12 and college spending. College spending fairly high because you've got a lot more technology involved in that. A few more other additional costs wrapped into that as well. And Leighton, we always talk about the composition of these surveys. In this case, Deloitte collected data from around 1,200 parents with at least one child in K-12 and another 1,025 parents of college students.
Deloitte is a highly respected firm, just FYI, but we always add the caveat that this is very difficult to extrapolate based on a smaller sample size. So there's lots of room for error here. If you just think about the number of those people that are surveyed, there's so many more millions of people that are making back-to-school purchases. But Deloitte, like Trent was alluding to, is a very reputable firm, been around forever. And this study shows us one thing. People, particularly parents, are willing to spend a lot in back-to-school sales and back-to-school items that their kids need, especially with those kids that are transferring, let's say from an elementary school to a middle school to a high school. Everything becomes new and different. And by the way, more expensive because a lot of things are technology-based nowadays. And it's just funny, Trent, I do have to add one quick note for our listeners. It was not that long ago when you and I were saying how much it was horrible that we would have to be looking at sales within stores when we were in school, really promoting the back-to-school initiative, saying that, look, it's only June or July, and yet everyone is already talking about future back-to-school sales in the retail environment. It's kind of depressing if you're a student and you still have a month and a half, 2 months to go before you have to even go to school to see these kinds of things, reminding them that they have to step foot in school in a few weeks. But back to the story, around 13% of the money is expected to be spent on electronic gadgets this year, offsetting an expected decline for computers and hardware to 12.4% of overall spending. Again, Best Buy is at the forefront of our attention in this category as the company continues to buck tepid expectations held by most just not that long ago, a few years ago, when people thought that Best Buy was going to be, in fact, the next Circuit City. Amazon will always be a player in this space. Does Walmart continue to build on their market share here, or perhaps Target? Well, speaking of Walmart and Target, Trent, 88% of parents from the K-12 survey plan to visit mass merchant stores. Note that we said visit, not shop online. This survey indicates that still the vast majority of shoppers intend to venture into the brick and mortar wilderness for their goods this year, particularly for those back to school items. And for Target, I had actually mentioned last year, Trent, how impressed I was with Target's sort of use of sales floor space. So throughout the year, obviously there are seasonal categories. We think of Halloween, we think of Christmas, we think of all of these times of the year in which several aisles get taken up for merchandise that's related to these particular periods. And to be honest with you, back to school is an important period, but it's just interesting to me in that they take up in an average Target around four aisles or four to five aisles worth of space during this particular season. So this really tells you that they are doubling down on their customer expectation that people are going to be spending a lot, and they're not only going to be spending a lot of money, they're going to be doing it for a variety of merchandise. That merchandise obviously is taking up end caps, it's taking up pods, it's taking up shelves down the main aisles, it's taking up shelves towards the front of the store. They are really going all out in order to make the customer not shop anywhere else. And I find that extremely interesting because this article points out that it will be very hyper-competitive this year. The majority of the shopping is expected to happen during late July, by the way, and early August. However, some parts of the country are starting to see an earlier push for back to school. It's interesting because so often we hear complaints about how early back to school sales begin, and this is something that I had previously alluded to in our personal experience. However, an increasing number of school districts are actually starting earlier in the summer, so it only makes sense that people are going to be promoting these sales sooner than later. And so this is going to be allowing for more professional development days during the school year itself for the staff and so forth. One district near Trent, actually, we were speaking before recording this very podcast, has actually adopted a 2-week spring break, forcing the schedule to start earlier and run a little bit later, something that area retailers have to adjust to. So if you think about it in terms of the localization efforts, the efforts that have been put forth by the aforementioned Target and Walmart to sort of localize each individual store, they have to consider those types of things. So they have to look at, are the public schools differentiating in terms of the school schedule? I know where I had just moved from in Kansas, they had done the same thing. They actually went a couple weeks earlier and then decided the very next year to go a couple weeks later in August again. So it's a very good point to be made that retailers, if they want to be smart, if they want to be diligent, if they want to capture those sales dollars, they have to pay attention to those local demographics, those local school policies, and most importantly, the demand for those types of items.
And you mentioned it wasn't that long ago that you and I were looking at these sales starting in July, bemoaning the start of school. I hate to tell you, but it was probably longer ago than you remember there. But in any case, one of the things that always intrigues me is the fact that some of these surveys come out and say one thing, but then we kind of see other effects there. For example, the NRF last year said 55% of back-to-school and college shoppers say they're planning their shoppings around big sales events, Prime Day, 4th of July, Labor Day, which is a little bit later on. A lot of schools have started by then, but certainly Labor Day in some circumstances. Yet we hear in this survey by Deloitte that most of the shopping is going to be done in late July and early August. That comes after Prime Day, after July 4th, and before Labor Day. So just because a lot of people are planning their shopping around sales events doesn't mean the shopping actually happens around those sale events. And to that end, I think this is going to be a big year, an even bigger year than it was last year, for those off-price retailers that you mentioned. TJ Maxx, Marshalls, Ross, Burlington. They are going to be, I feel like, the major players, especially in apparel, which again is the largest back-to-school category historically, projected to be the largest back-to-school category this year. I think if they can make a play outside of those sales events, if they can stick their neck out outside of those sales events, because they aren't really known for that at all, I think you're going to see an even bigger impact. And it's something that Neil Saunders, who we look towards a lot for data in terms of retail, he's mentioned it in the past, saying, you know, a lot of customers are going towards off price. And what does that mean if the economy does go into a downturn? Are the larger stores going to be left out to dry even more so? But I do think off-price has that attractive play for a lot of consumers. It's, again, the treasure hunt aspect. It's letting your kids shop along with you, that type of thing. And you also get a larger selection there because, let's face it, you know, if you go to a Walmart and shop for back-to-school clothes, they're going to have some different t-shirts and different designs, but ultimately TJ Maxx, Ross, the likes of Marshalls and so forth, they're going to have hundreds of different types of t-shirt designs in one space as long as they've done their buying correctly. And we've talked about earnings calls from TJX, from Ross, about how they've amped up their buying initiatives. They're trying to hold more inventory on hand for larger events like back to school, for the holidays. So I think this is going to be a big year for them when it comes to back to school. Again, don't have the data to back it up, but it just seems like all trends are pointing to off-price having a really strong late summer to fall.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We'll wrap up the Retail Focus podcast by each addressing a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. I'll go first again this week. Mine's fairly short. You know, I noticed an article in The Packer, who actually we referenced earlier on in the show. I had actually gone back there to research some for that 7-Eleven story. And I usually go to this news outlet pretty frequently because we like to cover the produce industry. There are multiple publications out there for the produce industry, including Produce Retailer, that we really enjoy reading. But The Packer always keeps track of the most highly sought after or highly searched fruits and vegetables on a platform called the Produce Market Guide. And what this does is this connects buyers and sellers. So basically, what companies will do is go on there, search for a particular item, and then perhaps try to locate that from a seller or from a distributor. This last week, the most highly sought after produce item, at least in terms of searches there for Produce Market Guide, were figs. And I think this is interesting because we've been hearing about figs picking up momentum now for, seems like, about 15 years. I actually recall reading an article in 2006 that said, hey, pomegranates are the next big fruit now, but the next one after pomegranates are going to be figs. And they might be right. It's just a ways down the road. But the number one searched item in their database were figs. And that's interesting to me because figs are a difficult product to sell fresh. They don't have a very long shelf life. They really have to be transported quickly and under refrigeration. And the most you see them usually in grocery stores in most parts of the country, at least parts of the country that aren't warmer weather, are perhaps dried or pre-packed. So the reason I'm looking ahead here, will you start to see more figs in stores as you move towards the core of fig season? And we're getting right about there. So July, August, will you start to see more figs in stores? Will you start to see more things done with figs, maybe more value-added products surrounding figs? But what is going on that has made them this popular? You know, there's a lot of other products on this guide that are pretty common. You have cherries, you have watermelon, you have tomatoes, you have blueberries. But figs just seem like an outlier there. Also, dragon fruit came in at number 9, which I found to be interesting. So that's what I'm looking ahead towards, is really the produce section. I'm going to be keeping an eye to see what produce retailers are doing surrounding figs, how they're marketing them, and more importantly, if they can turn over product to keep them from going bad on the shelves if they're selling them fresh.
My looking ahead story will also be relatively short this week. I am looking at Amazon.com. No, not because of some scandal or some sales expectations, but because on Thursday, Amazon unveiled plans to actually undergo a more intensive training program for its United States workforce. So around 100,000 workers, or a third of its U.S. workforce in turn, by 2025 are going to be really retrained, in other words, into more advanced jobs or to be assisted into finding new careers outside of Amazon.com altogether. And this is interesting because they're going to be infusing a lot more cash, around $700 million. It equates to around $7,000 per worker if the workers do volunteer. We're assuming that one third of the U.S. workforce will actually be interested in this voluntary training. But you're looking at the additional money going towards Amazon's Technical Academy, Associate 2 Tech, which is training for its fulfillment center employees, Machine Learning University, which actually helps those in tech really hone in their skills with machine learning. Amazon Career Choice, Amazon Apprenticeship, AWS Training and Certification, all of these designed to really boost their own business prowess within the technical aspects of the goings-on with the company day-to-day. But it's interesting to me, Trent, and this is why it's my looking ahead, how many of these employees exactly, especially those non-skilled laborers, they say, that are really going to be affected by this, are going to utilize these training programs. Again, around $7,000 per worker if everyone utilizes it at $700 million total, and actually leave the company. And this may be a detriment to Amazon long-term, but I think they're looking at it in terms of really employee morale, helping their employees not only get educated, but give them different options so they can move around the company. And if there's one thing that we've heard, Trent, is that those fulfillment center employees are not always the happiest employees within the company. But then also, some of the things we hear, again, anecdotally, are those people that work in the corporate setting are also burnout. They feel as though they can't transition easily throughout the company. Again, these are just the stories that we've heard here and there. This doesn't apply to every single division within Amazon. But it's interesting to me how companies like this really are looking towards the future, and they recognize that some people may leave the company, but overall, it's going to be a net positive if employees are actually taking advantage of this. Some of the details are kind of left out, so we don't necessarily know if these people are going to be paid on the job for a lot of this training, or if you have to do it outside of your designated work hours. But overall, I think it's going to be a positive for Amazon, and it really, honestly, puts a positive spin on the company in terms of the public persona that they've been really trying to fight against all the negative news over the past 6 to 8 months. We're talking about New York City. We're talking about Jeff Bezos. We're talking about mediocre earnings. I think this is a good thing for the PR side of the business, and I think it's going to be a good thing for those specific employees that look to really take advantage of this additional training.
Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Leighton said he'd make it a short looking ahead. That was a rather long one, so we're going to close it out here. Reminder, again, check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. We'll be back a week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.